Blog Talk Radio.
The motherfucking saga continues.
Yo, yo, what's up, world? It's Badass Thuggin' like I usually do. And you better turn it up, bust some speakers out, cause we off the motherfucking cuff. You dig how we do it? Dog Pound Gangsters 2000 and beyond. Blech.
What's up with it, y'all? Man, don't change that sound. This your player partner, the legendary Cocaine. And you're tuned in live to Off the Cuff Radio. Better not touch that sound. Wiggling.
Yeah, yeah, this is Cassidy, the hustler. And right now, you listening to the Guillotine. Show them the respect they deserve, man. Off the Cut Radio, man. Y'all already know how they doing it, man. I need y'all to stay tuned. They've been doing it for years. So show them the respect they deserve. And you heard it out of bars, mom. Easy.
Keep it moving like this. Yo, this your boy Rampage. You're not rocking with the best. With Off the Cut Radio. Classic. History. Fix your face to all you haters. We off the cuff, baby.
What's up, everybody? This your girl, Bonnie Dollars, the queen of trap, representing Crenshaw. And you are now tuned in with Off the Cuff Radio. What's up?
What's up, y'all? This is Miss Irresistible, giving a shout-out to the live show on Friday nights, Off the Cuff Radio. And I'm live from the 704. Make sure y'all tune in for the blazing hot music.
Kids, what it ain't, what it do. Chilly Chill from that original Lynch Mob. Off the Cuff Radio, always where it's at on Friday night. West West, y'all.
I have to say,
and you are now tuned in at the Live is Direct show on the web on Friday nights, Off the Cuff Radio. I'm your host, King Eric, and this show here is sponsored by Buddy Boy Entertainment, Da Vinci Clothing, Core Financial, Jesse Boutique. I got my host, T-Max, with the facts in the building.
What it do, y'all. Another Friday night of fantabulousness. This is OCCS in the building. I'm the co-pilot of this first-class flight of flesh. We are live and direct. Shout out to our co-host in spirit, Ella, Sandman, and Lady Chinchilla, Ella. And tonight is a very, very, very special show, ladies
T-Max,
and gentlemen.
Hold on. I think your audio's a little bit, something's up with the audio. Try to call back real quick.
Okay.
You sound like a robot. Y'all can hear me? It's ecstatic.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you. Hold on, just call back.
Okay.
Yeah, that's Blog Talk messing with the kid, man. So we're going to see if you have any little technical difficulties real quick. I'm going to have him call back. Okay, we see we're going to bring him on.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir. We good now.
Okay, perfect. All righty. Well, it's a little bit technical difficulties, but we are live and direct. And as I said, ladies and gentlemen, this is a very, very, very special show tonight. Our guest tonight is a young lady whose talent is beyond tremendous. She is a luminary representing that DMV. You've heard her back in the day when she dropped her banging-ass track, Young, Sad, and Blue. The girl has a golden voice that matches her platinum genius. She is one of the most inventive, creative, and such a sweet soul, and we are so honored and privileged to have her. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, the one, the only outstanding, Lisette Chi-Chi. Hey, boo!
Hello!
Hey!
Hi, how are you guys doing?
We are great, and how are you?
I'm good. I'm just enjoying this nice weather we're having today. Nice and sunny still in L.A.
Yes, living that Cali life so nice. Yes.
What's popping?
Man, look, we are so happy to have you on the show. You know, you are one of the true jewels of R&B, you know, who made a hell of a contribution. You know, we did the pre-interview talk, you know, a couple of times. I told you I was mad as hell that album didn't come out because the stuff I'd heard on YouTube going some years back that got leaked, I mean, your music was absolutely incredible. And, you know, obviously through Facebook, IG, we've been friends on it for a while. And, you know, when I told King, like, we got to get her on, you know, my brother was like, hey, we got to do this. So we know you got a little bit of time, you know, minimal time. So I guess we're going to get right to it. You know, tell us a little bit about, you know, how you started in the game, you know, what went on and, you know, all the way to now.
Yeah. Well, I don't have that much time. That would take forever.
I know.
But
why we're gonna do a part two to this.
It was cool. I got really lucky and I just, you know, I used to be on the show called Teen Summit and I met super producer Dallas Austin Bear and he signed me in the singing group I was in. He told him he had a phone call in Studio B where they shot Video Soul, and he came in there thinking that he had a phone call, but it was a girls group that was auditioning for him. And we sang. He called like a month later when I just happened to be skipping school one day. I was at home. The phone rang. I didn't know who it could be. I answered it with him, and that just kind of changed the trajectory of my life, so. I ended up leaving home at 16 to go move to Atlanta and start my career in music. And that's how it all happened.
Now, what was it like linking up with Dallas? Because Dallas was big at that time. You know, he was really like, you know, with Rowdy Records. I want to say he was actually the same, you know, about, a, you know, he would eventually discover, you know, some, you know, dope legendary singer. I think her name was Monica, you know. So, you know, yeah, you know.
It was really cool
was
back
it?
Then.
Mm-hmm.
It was really cool back then because Monica was really, like, we were all around the same age. I think Monica was probably, like, about two years younger than me. So that was
mm-hmm.
the closest person that was in my age group at the time when we were all hanging around Dart, because it was, like, Dallas and Dave Gates and, like, Mario Winans and, like, all the producers. They were, like, you know, 20-year-olds driving cars, you know, living that young millionaire lifestyle. And the rest of all the other girls that were around, like Joy, my label mate, they were all in that same age, but Monica and I were, like, the only, like, under 18 people that were in the circle, aside from, like, the the Illegal, that group called
Illegal,
that was kind of like Chris Cross and Escape.
Yeah, Malik and Jamal.
And then, Malik and Jamal. So, like, there was a small portion of us who were kids back then. So we kind of all, like, you know, had the same vibe because we were in the same age group. But it was pretty cool watching those people kind of get their start. They all kind of were already started before, so I just kind of got to watch them. And it was dope. It was a dope experience. Those were.
And he said Joy.
That started my life off
that
way was dope.
Right. You said Joy was your label mate too, right?
Right.
But yeah, because she had an album called The Pendulum Vibe back in the day. Had a song Sunshine in the Rain.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember it. Yeah. So when you mentioned, you know, Mario, Yellow Man, Winans, you know, because those names you were dropping, this is also the infancy of what would end up becoming, later on, you know, he would become a member of Puffy's, you know, producers, you know, the Hitmen. Tell us, what was it like with that Atlanta music scene in terms of, because, I mean, this is like, you know, before, you know, like, you know, because we still hadn't seen them two dope boys in a Cadillac, you know, Dre and Three Stacks, known as Outkast. You know, they hadn't quite come into the game just yet, or they were really kind of beginning. But y'all had, I mean, going to Atlanta, I mean, this is like when Freaknik is at his peak, you know, Criss Cross is jumping. I mean, you know, it's just like y'all got, it's just, everybody just thinks about it, Atlanta back in the day as being one big party down there. Is that what it's like?
It was, and it was like that was my when people think about their childhood and their high school days, like that
mm-hmm.
was mine. I didn't like go in a college dorm, you know. I moved to Atlanta. I left my mom's house in the 10th grade, so I legit grew up around all of those people. You know what I mean?
Wow.
And so, and even if you just want to like. We're not just talking like the urban scene. Dallas was working with all type of people. So like, I remember being a fly on the wall in Studio A when he was working with Madonna, and I was there.
Oh, wow.
I was like 16. I was about to turn 17, and I remember that. No, I was about to turn 18, and we were all supposed to go out for my 18th birthday. Like. Dallas, a few other people that we were going out to celebrate the fact I was finally turning 18, right? And she was still recording on that day. I remember that. And I remember just being a fly on the wall and not being able to have my party until like 2 o'clock in the morning because he was working with Madonna. I mean, it was a surreal experience. And, you know, just that was kind of like the beginning of my life. Like, okay, well, this is Madonna, so it's a big deal, of course. You know, I'm sitting there, like, stuck, but I'm also waiting because I know there's a party. So it's just like, you know, life back then was different because music made a whole lot of money. So people just moved way differently. And it still does, but there was just, it was a different climate, and we really all really loved music. Like, we loved music back then. It wasn't about becoming successful in numbers necessarily back then. That was the overall goal. Yes, you wanted to sell a million records, but I guess because back then it was easier to sell a million records, and I was with people who were selling a million records, I grew up in an environment of musicians who were really just trying to be great. They weren't trying to sell a million records because they had already done that. So their focus was actually every day, every studio, every line, every track, being like they're focusing on their craft. You know what I mean? Whereas now in the industry, like everywhere you go, the vibe is more about like how you look or like just, and when I say how you look, I'm not talking about like your image. I'm talking about like how you look generally, like how you floss, how you come off, like how many other people like you. That drives this generation. How many other people like you drives this generation. Whereas when I was coming up in that environment, it was really about how dope you were and how you made people feel.
Right.
That's the key difference between those two things and those two time periods. And I feel honestly very grateful to still very much be a part of what's happening now, because I don't feel like I think a lot of people with my background, especially if I think about had I have gone platinum back then, had the records that you love so much come out and everybody, I would have probably been labeled as somebody that made it back then. You know what I mean? But I'm still very excited and still very hungry because I feel like I still have a lot in me that has not come out. So I appreciate being a part of both worlds. You know what I mean? The old and the new.
Yeah, definitely. And when we look at it, too, from that perspective of it, LaFette, because this was a proliferation of a lot of groups. You know, King, you know, my brother and me, we talk about it all the time in terms of that 90s era of R&B, which... I mean, I'm just going to go ahead and give a laundry list. When you talk about Mary J. coming in 92, Jodeci coming in 92, H-Town, 93, Intro, 92, Drama with their album Open Invitation, 95, Image, you know, Nothing Nice, you know, Yourself, the group Indonesia with the song Do Things, Escape. I mean, SWV, can't forget them. I mean, Faith Evans. I mean, God, I mean, do you all really understand that you all not only came with dope-ass music, but you all just influenced a whole generation, just like hip-hop and what they call the second golden age? What you all came with was the second golden age of R&B. I mean, we will never see another era like that again of what you all contributed. I mean, what was it like just seeing all that magic just come everywhere?
I think one thing people have to realize is that, you know, when you grow up and you start getting grown and sexy, you start to kind of taste. That's the nature of all people that when we age, we look back. Start to, like, do this thing where we're like, oh, that will never happen again. Well, if you think about it, the moments that you had 60 seconds ago will never happen again. Time is always moving forward. You know what I mean? And so I think I'm not one of those people that chases eras like that, like we need to repeat that era. I always feel like we got to – you have to focus on the now, like how things are happening right now. And now, to answer your question, it was a very monumental time in my life and in music. Some of the names that you named, like Intro, you know, I studied those records so much that I became, I used those intro, those harmonies, I used that whole New Jack Swing, I used that to shape and mold a sound for myself that got me in the door years later. So when Young Saturn Blue came out, I think it was officially released like in 98. Those
right,
records
yes,
that we're talking about, yeah, those records that we're talking about, you know, it took me a few years between 93, 94, 95 to really study those records. But in Atlanta, I will tell you, Atlanta was dope back then because you had several young black men who had become ridiculously successful, black millionaires, successful dreamers that turned their dreams into million-dollar companies. And they got a pass from these bigger companies, these bigger labels to do whatever it was they wanted so they could do it again. So they were these highly creative people who were trying everything and just out to experience life. I mean, I will tell you that we would wake up sometimes, like the way Young Saturn Blue came out, Dallas was like, you know what, y'all? We're going to go on a writer's retreat to Nashville. And we were like, Nashville? But in his mind, Nashville is, he's trying to create a vibe. I'm going to tell you, everybody's going to go to Nashville. That's where songwriters are. We're going to get away from everything, all the money, all the cars, everything. And we're all just going to put ourselves in the middle of Hitville, like song land. You know what I mean? Like Nashville. And I remember I was in Nashville. It felt dry to me. And I remember being in that apartment and just like taking, at that time it was cassette tapes, and I was just listening. It was like a writer's camp, very much like what you would describe, very much like what Missy described Teddy's camp. Like, it was Teddy, Dallas, Puffy, they all basically did this. They did the same thing within their camp to try to create records. Mm-hmm. So they would take all of the talents and all the creative people and put them somewhere all together, and we would all just do what we do. And so I would routinely get a whole bunch of tracks to write to, and I would just listen to them, and I would pick one. And I'll never forget, it was me. The producers on that retreat were Jazzy Faye, Arnold Henning, Marlon Winans, X, DJ X, X, and Dallas, and I want to say, who else was there? There was one more producer that was there that I'm forgetting, that I can't remember. Anyway, those are just some of the few people that were there. Deborah Killings was there, and we all just, like, put our heads together, right? So they gave me this track. I got Young Saturn Blue. I don't know why I gravitated towards that. Oh, Carlos and Dada, they were there. They were the new kids on the block. And they took the Portishead sample, and they made that track for Young Saturn Blue, the original one. You guys are playing a remix, which is dope. And they gave me the track. I was super high because I learned to smoke weed as soon as I got to Atlanta. So I started smoking at 16. I was high out of my mind. I remember, like, I got so high, I just felt like I was always peeing. That's how high I stayed back then. I just felt like, oh, did I pee on myself? Did I pee on myself? That's how the weed was just that good. I'm not going to lie. And so.
Oh, what? No, even the weed was different back then.
The weed was different. It was just different because it was money weed. doesn't hit the same now. But, like, so, yeah, it was like all those people and, you know, they gave me the track. I wrote to it, and I got to the studio, and I had, you know, one of my close buddies back then was this engineer called Leslie Brathwaite, and he was Dallas's intern. He was an intern at DART. And, you know, so they always put me with Leslie because I was the youngest person, and they were like, you could be with the intern. And Leslie and I developed this chemistry. Anyway, while we were recording at this studio in Nashville, I can't remember the name of the studio, the guy comes in, and he's like, it's so funny that you, you know, the guy that runs the studio, he popped in the session just to see what we were doing, Leslie and I. And he goes, it's so funny that you would, song is called Young, Sad, and Blue. You know, Elvis recorded Blue Suede Shoes in that same room that you're standing. I was like, what? It was just like, that was the vibe. I know, it was just like the vibe there was just kind of crazy. But, you know, it was, for me being that young, money was just easy in the music industry. Everybody was making it. I cannot tell you how fast it came, and like everybody had Porsches. Freaknik was always off the chain, and it was just like you said, just everybody was in their art. You know what I mean? We were in our art every day. We would wake up and be in our art. Wake up and be in our art.
Yo,
it's amazing.
I mean,
it was a good life.
I missed part of what y'all was talking about, the nostalgia effects about the old Atlanta versus the new Atlanta.
I mean, King, how many times do we talk about
I'm just getting back. I'm just
trying
to follow up because, you know, I was trying to make sure the phone was working, but.
Right.
What were y'all building up on?
Look, we just building up on how the scene was back in the day and just the nostalgia and just, you know, just what it was like during that time. I mean, King, how many times have you and me talked about it in terms of that whole Atlanta movement? I mean, you're talking about the Atlanta days. In terms of when Dion was with the Braves and the Falcons, I mean, you're talking about Babyface, you know, L.A. Reid had LaFace Records, you know, I mean, Lennox Mall, Greenbrier, Underground, Peachtree with Eric Sermon and the Rim Shop. I mean,
Greenbrier. I remember Greenbrier.
Yes. I mean, you know, it was considered during that time, let's say, the Black Mecca. Like you said, this was where all the dreams, the aspirations, the desires, the determination, this is where the fruits of realization were harvested down there. You know, and I mean, it just had a vibe. I went down there years ago as a youngin', and the energy, you could just feel it everywhere in terms of just the vibrant life, just the comorous of camaraderie. I mean, and I'm just so deprived from my childhood because I heard the stories about Freaknik. I'm so mad I never got to go.
Now, y'all know they're trying to bring their energy back with Freaknik. They tried to bring it back last week, I believe.
Yeah, they did. Shout out to Elevation Magazine, you know, 87 Records, BMF Cash we had on last week. Shout out to King Stivers, the publisher of the magazine, the whole BMF down there. Much love. We see y'all. We rock with y'all. Yeah, they said that basically they're basically in the process of trying to, you know, get it back again. They said it went pretty well. Now, today with social media, because this is going to be two parts, Ella said, because when you talked about, because we're going to hit two birds with one stone on this, when you talk about the music industry back then, the buzz was generated from an organic perspective. We're going to get to when the song started hitting hard, because that's when you would get your feature in Vibe magazine. You know, what was it like in terms of seeing all of this? And then from a perspective of it, because we know with social media now, all the shit that used to happen at Freaknik back then, I just don't think we're going to have the same time.
Hell no.
Well, I think the pandemic probably made that impossible.
Well, I think with the pandemic, we're going to, God bless, we're going to make it past. But I think just the party atmosphere, because I saw home videos of Freaknik from years ago in the 90s, and, oh, my God, I'm like, I didn't know that it was like we could do all of this out in public. stories.
It seemed more unified back then versus now. It's kind of like more divided now just based off people's mentality. Like, some people want to go with right, some people want to go with left. It's too many, and you know, there's a lot of different mix of opinions on direction. Whereas you had before, you had a lot of people, they was pretty much on more unified front. I think first what we got to do, we got to get that unity back together.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah,
I mean,
it was
too, like, it's going to take, like, it's not going to be us necessarily. It's going to take the same age group that created Freaknik to, like, pull it off, and then we can all go. But, like, I mean, like, that's what I was saying. Like, you can't just constantly, it's natural for people to want to go back, but it's important for the younger generation to kind of create vibes that make everybody want to be there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that's the issue that people have. It's like when nostalgia becomes a marketing tool and they try to recreate something that was organic before, and it just doesn't come off right. That's why I feel like how you feel sometimes. Sometimes you just got to leave the best stuff alone. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is how I feel.
Man.
I feel like focusing on the past, it does make it so you can't see the future. You know what I mean? And I'm all about the future. Like, what are we doing now? Like, how do I create that vibe? How do I create an even better? I think all creatives and all artists' goal really should be, how do I recreate myself? That's what I focus on. So I don't think it's about, like, going back to what you were. Like, what are you right now? I love the fact that Pharrell did that Something in the Water thing, and I hope he does that every year, you know. And, like, I feel positive about the future. We just have to put our heads together, you know what I mean? And once the pandemic is, like, makes its way out of our communities, then, you know, people will feel more free to, like, gather. People are gathering now, but I know a lot of people that won't gather regularly. Like, you might be able to get somebody to come out to something, like, once in a few months, but I'm talking about some of us used to go out all the time. You know what I mean? Like, every weekend. I know, shoot, playing in a band, I play the club 5 nights a week, you know? So.
Yeah. I mean, so when we look at it from that time.
I think it's a case of, I was going to say, too, that I think it's a case, and I want to ask you guys this, too. Do you think it's a case of where the reason why people go back to nostalgia is because they're creatively bankrupt?
Ladies first.
No, I think it's just natural.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If it's not the best time of your life, you're going to be thinking about it. You know what I mean? If those are your best years, you're going to think about it. But that's what makes you old, when that's your only best time. Whereas if you look at old people who really live their life fully, they have so many best times that there's no more to have. And I'm just like, that's why I say, like, I don't hold on to one time period. It's just like, I constantly move forward. What do you think, Tom?
I think more than anything, when we look at nostalgia is something that has such an elemental part because it has to do with the impenetrable, indelible, defining moment of what our existence was. It's the apex of where we were at that particular time that means so much. That's why a lot of times, because everybody's going to have a nostalgia. This generation with the music now, there's certain songs that's going to be their nostalgia. And that's okay because that's how they grew up. Just like our parents with the nostalgia, you know, with Motown, you know, Earth, Wind & Fire, you know, all of them, that's their nostalgia. I'm going to be biased because I think the era we all came from, we had a mix of everything in terms of we were coming along at a time where all the things we saw with music videos, radio, even the beginning of social media, we saw all of that. So we understand the standard that was set at that time in terms of why it is so impactful today. In terms of the music, I think that's why being a journalist, you know, like King and myself, you know, we hold ourselves to a high standard because we know what it was like in terms of what you had to go through at a particular moment to make music. You know, if you could get it ain't like back in the day 30 years ago where you had a video phone or now you got digital cameras that you can spend $800, $1,000 on and then you got a computer program and you can put together video. I mean, back in the day, I mean, to get a camera equipment, a 8mm, 12mm, 36mm camera, and you actually got to have people moving around. To get in a studio, I mean, it was crazy back then. I mean, this was like a big deal for heads in the hood if you could, like, get something together. I mean, to record a song is one thing. To shoot a video for it? Shit. I mean,
You know we're really going to be looking back and having nostalgia?
What's that?
This is what I don't want to be like, John Greedy. He's going to be sitting there talking about, yeah, back in the days when I was, you know what I mean? And I'm not the type of person who, I don't want to have those moments. Like, I don't want my best time to be my last time. Like, I just don't want
right.
to have, I don't want to have to go back like that. I want to keep creating myself. He's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. He's going to have to, like, recreate himself. You got to, you can't, if you just sit back and think about what you were, yo, it's just, you can't do that in life. You gotta move forward. And I think those were the dope years for R&B, no doubt. We will not get those back. But, like, what's going to happen next? And, like, if you could be a part of what happens next, if you want to be a part of what happens next, then move
yeah.
in with it, whatever that movement is going to be. Or do you want to be on the sidelines just talking about what was and, you know, like, what was the best time? And I think I'll tell you, I speak for everybody.
Yeah, we're talking about the good old days all day.
Yeah, and I think all those people that were back then in that time, they're trying to find the next thing, too. I think I speak for all of us. Like, I mean, I know Dallas has a new company that he's working on, a new distribution company. I can tell you that, like, several people I know in that circle, they're, like, looking for what is next and trying to make that same impact but move forward
mm-hmm.
and... You know, as much, and my position is very controversial because as much as I see how dope R&B was back in the day, I do know that, and the kids appreciate it now, but there was room to grow back then, and there's room to grow
yeah.
right now.
Yeah.
And some of my
yeah.
favorite artists are not, like my favorite artists now, they might have elements of what we started and elements of what we created, but... Like, I cannot stop listening to Alex Isley. I cannot stop listening to, like, Sabrina Claudio. I cannot stop listening to some of these things. And I don't have bad taste when it comes to anything in life, especially music. So I know that what's next and what's coming is, there is depth in it, and there are things that we can love as much, but which is all in different places. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Because we got to because we know you got a limited time, so we're going to fast track this a little bit. So, because we're going to fast track this from when the songs, from when Young Sad and Blue blows up to the buzz, once you get the Vibe article, and then, you know, the hiatus, and then to now. So let's start real quick from a perspective of when the song starts taking off. You get your Vibe. What is it when you get the Vibe article? What is that like when you realize the song is, like, moving heavy? Like, it's really, like, gaining steam.
That was, like, a very hard part in my life, actually, because what a lot of people don't know is Karen Vivey and, like, my team, it was Kenny Burns, it was Karen Vivey, it was a lot of people that are really big people in the music industry right now. This was the beginning of, you know, I was one of the artists in the beginning of their career, right, that was taking off. And we did chart, but we charted at a time... Young Sad and Blue charted, but Young Sad and Blue, as soon as it charted, I think I saw that song as like 28 on the Hot 100s. I can't remember the number, but it was really, for me, it was beginning to accomplish something. But what I knew behind the scenes was that the label I was signed to, which was Rowdy, was actually merging with Free World, who put out the record, but they came to some type of disagreement. I was in the process of losing my deal when that song took off. So for me, it was
man.
Like, a lot of people don't know that, but, like, I was going through the motions of interviewing, and, you know, I had to go to New York, and I stayed in Dallas's apartment at the time, and he lived downstairs from Tom Cruise. And, like, I was living the dream, but I was scared out of my mind because it was all about to be over, and I knew it. And it was just like, how am I going to keep it?
Wow.
And, you know, I'm a little fish in that whole big thing. So I remember like what going places and be like, oh my God, aren't you that girl, that Sad and Blue girl? I remember signing autographs, and the whole time in my heart it was like, God, are you about to take this away from me? And but a lot of people don't know, like, that's when it was all, when you saw it starting is actually when it was ending. And it was out of my control, you know. And
that's
what a lot of people don't know, yeah, right? A lot of people don't know that that was not my first time signing to Dallas. So the whole BET thing, when I signed to him with the group, we had gotten signed, and we recorded this whole project, this whole album. It's a whole host of songs you have never heard, Thomas. And everybody loved the music so much. Back then, when your record label was signed to a parent company like Arista, Rowdy was signed to Arista, you would record project, right? You remember, you would record your project, but then you had to present the artist to the big label, the parent company. When we presented to Clive Davis back then, it was he looked at me and he was like, oh, hell no. You're not a star. You're not pretty enough. Stars are born. They're not made. Why don't you just scratch this whole album, Dallas, give it to a whole nother group, and she can write everything. And I lost that deal for 3 years before you saw Young, Sad, and Blue. So by the time this was happening the second time, and I tell this story so people understand the depth of why they have not seen me constantly put out music, you know, it started so early for me. And it, the ups and downs started so early that it kind of crushed. I was a kid. So that guy, like, crushed
me. Yeah.
You in 11th grade and somebody's telling you in 11th grade, oh, hell, the biggest person in music? The biggest person in music. Responsible for Whitney Houston, responsible for all those people. It's like, you know what your kid, if you got kids out there, you know your kid's mind is 16, 17 years old. Tell them, take the biggest person in music to look them in their face and tell them, you're not pretty enough, you don't look good enough. That will shut you down. And so back then I had enough courage to pick myself up and give it another shot with another deal with him, because eventually he left Clive. And he called me back. I was actually, I feel compelled to tell this story. After my group, we were called Pretty Hips and Thighs, and this is important. Chucky Thompson put this group together. I know Thomas knows, but everybody knows who Chucky is, right? So in D.C., Chucky Thompson, who's responsible for Mary J. Blige, My Life, Faith Evans, we basically, the day that I got signed, the time that I got signed to Dallas when he came to BET, it wasn't just me. It was me and Chucky. And we, you know, I told Chucky that he put this group together. I told him, bring the group to Teen Summit that day because Dallas was coming and we could probably get signed. So this group that I got signed to with Chucky when I was in the 10th grade, that was Chuck's group. So that's the group that initially moved to Atlanta. Those girls were in college. I was in high school. When that group got dropped, I moved out here to L.A., right? I'm going to tell this story to somebody. I want people out there to know what it takes to really make it in anything you want to do. Because Thomas knows, a lot of people know I am still pushing, I'm still putting music out. I put a project out 3 years ago. I don't intend to stop. I moved to Los Angeles for a play with a good girlfriend of mine called her name is Sy Smith. She's an amazing indie artist. We moved out here because we got cast in this play. The play was called The Shiznit, and it was starring Lavelle Evans and A.J. Johnson, all these young black comedians that were L.A. natives that were just starting to come up. And because the play opened, we were out here rehearsing for like 2 months. I was out here getting skinny because at the time everybody in L.A. was skinny, so I would get up in the morning, I would not eat, and I would run 5 miles and go to rehearsal. That was my life, Hollywood.
Oh,
and
wow.
So the play opened, right? And nobody showed up in the audience. And immediately the director of the play told us, me and my girlfriend Sai, the play's not going to work. Y'all got to get out the apartment. And we were like, okay, are you flying us back home to D.C.? Like, what are you doing? and he just disappeared. So here I am at this time. This was after the group got dropped, right? So here I am, 17 years old or so, and I'm sitting in L.A., and I'm calling my mom. She worked at UDC. My mother was, like, on furlough. UDC had got the government, D.C. government had gotten this furlough, so my mother was flat broke. I had no way to get home. I was stuck in Los Angeles in this apartment. Now, my girlfriend, Sai, had a boyfriend out here, but I was a loner, always had been, so I had anybody. So you know what happened to me? This is amazing. This story, this is the amazing, most amazing story of my life. I had to leave the apartment. I got a suitcase full of stuff. I had two suitcases. I had to leave the apartment, and we lived in North Hollywood. And I sat in a park in North Hollywood, and I thought about my future. I had quarters. I had like $200, and I kept calling everybody I know to try to give me a ticket to get back home. And it started to get dark, and nobody could help me. And it got really dark, and I didn't have anywhere to go. So I slept on the park bench. And when I woke up, my hands, both hands were on my suitcases like that was going to stop somebody from stealing it. This was in North Hollywood Park, right on Morrison Park, right on
yeah.
Magnolia Park, right in there.
Yeah.
Okay. And that was the first night that I slept in a park homeless at 17. And I woke up in that morning and I was like, yo, I got to figure something out. So it cost $8 to shower at the YMCA. That was right across the street. I went over there with my suitcases. I took a shower, and I said, okay. After I got out the shower, I was like, okay, let me figure out something to do. I saw a diner. They had a help wanted sign in the window, and I was like, okay, maybe I could talk myself into a job. I did. I got a job as a waitress, so I worked that day, and then I went back to the park at night. I worked a double so I would get to the park late. I slept in the park, that same park, for four nights in a row, talked myself into an apartment across the street. I got in the apartment. I'm thanking God. I'm like, oh, my God, I'm in an apartment. I still have a cell phone so I can call people. And lo and behold, I was sitting in there in the apartment. My phone rings, and it's a man named David Gates. David Gates worked for Dallas. David calls me, and he goes, what's that? Dallas called me to tell you he's very sorry about what happened with you and Clive Davis and you getting dropped, and he wants you to come to Nashville and come to this writer's retreat. And I told Dave, I was playing big, y'all. I was playing big because I didn't have anything, right? So I told him, you know what, y'all would have to pay me $200,000 to come back for that later. Just playing big, right? He's mm-hmm. like, all right, Lizette, let me call you back. The next day he was like, you know, is Amy Goldson still your attorney? He's going to give you the $200,000. He wants you to get on a plane tomorrow and come to Nashville. And that's how I started working on Young Sound and Blues. So I'm just telling you, like, for me, it's been like 25 years. I don't spend a lot of time looking back.
You realize we're just sitting here with our mouths open right now because, I mean, wow. Oh, my God. Oh, man. Okay, no pun intended. Where do I unpack all of this? Because King, my brother, Lissette, sister girl, because this is a situation in terms of what y'all got to understand what happened to her. This happens to a lot of artists. This is the same thing. You know, not yes. to that extent, but this is what happened to D'Angelo some years ago when EMI folded up in America, and the original Voodoo album that he had, he lost that because, you know, the EMI is based in Europe. So the album he had, he lost it. That's why it took him so long between 95 and then 2000 when he dropped Voodoo, because the original Voodoo was supposed to drop in 97. So this is what happens when you're dealing with label politics and when either they're not going to pick up an artist, you know, when you're dealing with absorption of labels, it's a lot of business. We do not have nowhere near the time to break down the minutiae of how it works, but it's basically when a label is absorbed into another, essentially what happens, the parent label decides what's going to happen with the artist there.
But
said this gave y'all, yeah.
Loud got swallowed up, and then Sony took them over, and a lot of artists that
yeah.
was on Loud, that was, they suffered from it.
Yeah. Okay, so what's this? So you got the 200 racks. You make it back over to Nashville. So what happens after that in terms of, you know, what goes on after this?
I just decided that I will write my way back in, and I will figure it out. And I wrote Young, Sad, and Blue, and everybody – okay, so when you're a writer, what happens is you write a whole bunch of bullshit before you write something good. Everybody
right.
thinks, like, some of us that are passionate, we have this thing, like, we write records like it's the last, like, every record is going to take you there. But that's not
right.
the case. You actually have to, it's kind of like anything else you do, if you really want to get that one, you got to have 10,000 hours in every song. So I wrote a whole bunch of crap-ass records before, I don't know, can I cuss? I wrote a whole bunch
yes,
of
you can.
Bad records
yes, you can.
Before.
Off the cuff, baby.
Okay, cool. I wrote a whole bunch of, you know, crazy, dumb, like just horrible records. I feel like what they were horrible. They didn't make sense. Some of them I didn't finish. You know, I would maybe write a verse and just a chorus and not even touch the rest of it. I wrote a lot of those records before I wrote Young, Sad, and Blue. But when I wrote Young, Sad, and Blue, everybody started paying attention. Like Dallas loved it. Like, He loved it. He started. They passed that record around, and they actually gave it to. This is what I was told, was that they gave the record to Mary J. Blige, and she loved it. And Dallas and Puffy had a relationship. I heard that she recorded it, and when she recorded it, Faith decided there was some type of feud that y'all would probably know more than me because I don't remember everything
yeah, it
from
was...
back then because a lot of stuff.
It's some of it
yeah,
we
what
can
happened?
Talk
I don't
about
know
on it. Well, basically, this is because we're not, you know, because this is just from what was speculation. Because the issues with Faith and Mary stemmed from what was perceived as, because there's a lot of back end story about Puff and all of them. We're not going to get into that on air, but we will just keep it fundamental. Basically, the story goes, Mary felt like her position was being threatened when Faith came in. And there was some egos involved. Quick story. What happened with Faith's debut? Yeah, because what happened with Faith's debut album, the Love Don't Live Here Anymore, that initially her and Mary recorded, the tension was so bad, as the story goes, they recorded their vocals in separate sessions. They weren't even in the same studio together when it happened. This is how serious it was. And ultimately on later pressings, if you get Faith's first album, the first pressings of it, Mary is up there. The later pressings, Mary isn't up there when they repress the album. Her vocals are not up there. So it was serious between them in terms of the problems that they had at that time.
Yeah, and I was told that one of them recorded the record and also another record I wrote back in the day that Chucky did, one of them, they had recorded the record and one of them heard the other person and wanted the record. And so basically their feud made it so Dallas was like, just fuck it, you do it. You put it out, you do it. And I was like, okay, let's try this again. So that was my start as a solo artist because they didn't want the record. I had a record. He didn't want the record to go to waste, and he took a chance on me again as a solo artist, and he decided he was going to, you know, put me out. And that's how we got to that point. Mm-hmm.
I mean, like I told you, and thank God for YouTube, because I got to shout out my homie Humi Nature from Canada because I haven't talked to him in years online, but that was my ace. Because Humi Nature actually – I don't know where the hell he got it. I don't know how the fuck he did it, but he got that. He got your whole album, and he put it online. It ain't up there now, but goddamn it, when I first listened to it, I was blown away, especially Bus Stop. I heard that, and I was like, oh, my goodness. And, I mean, you know, this is really before streaming.
But Bus Stop, no. I got to correct you. Bus Stop, Give Me My Keys, those records came way They came like 5 years after this time, and that was a whole nother producer. Yeah. They came out way after, and this is a good way to tie this in. So that was another I'm going to get back up after I fell down. So by that point, I had one of my good girlfriends who was at the time that I met her, she was Dallas's baby's mom. I met her when she was pregnant with Dallas's son. But we became close friends, and she became an entertainment attorney. When I came back to D.C., I had kind of walked away from, you know, trying to get a record deal. That's what we used to do back then. I was trying to figure out what else I can do. And so I had a girlfriend who was working at Tommy Boy, my girlfriend Lee Rankin, and the president, Tom Silverman, really liked Lee. And so he happened to be listening. She was playing my music at her desk. This was in 2001. And Tom walked by her desk, and he was like, yo, who is that? That's amazing. And from there, I ended up, I can't remember my A&R's name back then, but in 2000 is when I got signed to Tommy Boy. And when I got the Tommy Boy deal, I created a series of records that I think some of which you have heard that Human Nature put out as well. So whoever that guy is, he's been like finding my music, and he's been like putting it out at several time periods. So I had same thing with Tommy Boy. Tom Silverman, I meet him. He's like, you are amazing. You're my next project. I absolutely love you. Take this whole heap of money, and we're going to have Christmas holiday, and y'all know the music industry. They used to do that. They used to just throw money at me back in the day blindly.
King,
like,
King,
I know you're going to, you know what
King
I'm saying?
Remember that interview? He talked about that money that was going around back in the day.
Yeah.
They used to throw money at you back in the day. It was like real money. Now, like, if you're not already selling records, you're not getting the type of money I was making at 19. Like, I'm telling you, like, easy, another $200,000 advance. Like, and I was so stupid back then. Like, I'm going to put $100,000 in my savings and $100,000 in my checking. I did not know what I was doing. I know now, you know, now I'm a business owner. I'm good. But back then, it was just fast money all the time. And so they broke for the holidays. They were like, you know, if you guys remember, the music industry used to shut down kind of around Christmas, fourth quarter. And so
right.
I signed my deal like in October of 2000 or 2001. I left. I took the money. I went back to Africa. I went to see all my relatives. I took, you know, my dad from Ivory Coast. So I went to see everybody, and then I came back, and Tommy Boy was closing. And so all of us were getting dropped, Latifah, De La Soul, like everybody. I was like, what am I supposed to do? And that's when one of my girlfriends was like, you need to, you know, she was like, she hooked me up with this guy who, this band in D.C. who was looking for a female singer. I had a shitload of money. I had bought some property in D.C. I didn't have anything to do at any time, any day. I didn't have anything to do with my life, so I was just like, let me just be in a band. And that's how I ended up singing in a go-go band. It was 4 years later where I got connected with this producer who made this advertisement in Craigslist. His name is Diesel. Diesel was from France. And Diesel put out an ad for a singer on Craigslist. And he was only in America because his wife was working at the World Bank. And he was a well-known French producer. And you know how, like, if you travel overseas, they have groups that are as popular in those countries as we have here, but just not. So he was a huge producer. He had a publishing deal with EMI. And he and I worked and put out those songs that you're talking about. I Wasn't the One, Bus Stop. Those songs came out around 2005, 2006. I had long been passed out of. I put those songs out myself, basically. Those were not like record deal songs. So about 2005 is when I started saying, you know what, screw the label thing. I'm gonna just get the money and put stuff out myself. And some of those records you're talking about, that you put out, yeah. That's that story.
Gotta do it.
Yeah. I mean, and one thing about it, Lisette, because your talent was, you know, we see so many artists like yourself that are just so insanely gifted, you know, so tremendously talented, and just suffer a terrible set of circumstances, but the comeback story is always better than the catastrophe that came before it. And to know that you still have a passion for this, tell us about, you know, going into the present day now, you know, what you got coming in terms of, like, what you've, you know, just over the years, how have you seen R&B change from where you started to how it's really energized you in the industry to create what you're creating now to gift us with?
I wish you could see what I'm looking at right now. Like, when I did about 5 years ago, I put out, because I told, so let me go back a little bit more. So around 2005, 2006, I make a series of songs called Bus Stop, I Wasn't the One, and a few other songs, and I started to get a little buzz in the city and with some of my fans from the Young Sad and Blue days, because people, I thank God every day that people still want to hear me. Like, you don't understand, like, not a day goes by where there's not somebody that like, yo, I want to let you know, I still love your music, I still love this. It's such a huge blessing, and I don't know what your fan of your audience is, but I'm sure it's big, but I want everybody listening to know that your favorite artist, we are people, and we, those DMs can lift us up so high sometimes, and there's not a day that goes by where somebody doesn't tell me that they want to hear me, and I didn't give myself this voice, so it's like I'm a human being that has something to give you, and sometimes we don't know if you want to hear it or not, but we still have the voice to sing, songs still come to us in the night, so it's like it's confirmation every time somebody, you know, says something positive like that, and through the years, people have continued to do that for me. And so what I did about, you know, 4 years ago, I was like, okay, forget it. I left the live music scene, and I you know, that the band I was in to pursue my music full time, and I started, we're talking about what's going on now, I started this company because I figured out this, all right, record labels, big ones, which there aren't so many right now, but they used to be funded by liquor companies and larger companies, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't know the labels ended up being real big tax write-offs for these larger companies. More money you make, you know what I'm saying? Y'all know about that, right? So
yeah, exactly.
The more money, yeah, okay, cool. So the more money you make, the more tax write-offs you need. I know this now because, you know, obviously my tax bracket has changed. So I had this idea. I was like, you know what? Not only do I need to pay my rent, but I want to be my own label, so how am I going to get the money? So another passion that I have is for decorating. I've always, in all the places I lived, all around, all this moving and shaking, living a gypsy life, I was the girl that lost their security deposit in every single apartment. I would paint something. I would do something crazy on the wall. So I turned that into a passion, and I started home staging. And I got just as good in decorating people's houses and as a home stager as I was in music. And in a few years, I was able to, working for different home staging companies. Yes, I'm an artist that got a job. I'm telling it all because I want other artists to even feel me on this. Like, this is my story. Take it, let it move you, or let it help you. So I left this band where I was performing 5 nights a week, and I'm like, okay, what's next in my life? At that point, I'm in my 30s, and I'm like, you know, I'm getting older, and I'm like, people are not getting signed as easily, so how am I gonna do this? So I started staging, and I was still singing background for people. So at that point, I did the Pink Prick tour with Nicki Minaj. And when I came home, I decided I was going to start my own staging company, right? So home staging is the art of, like, decorating a house for sale. Long, I won't go into the whole story and how I started the company, but I used, it's, this is, I'm in my fourth year of business, and I started off just by myself, one house at a time. I'm probably doing like one house a week, and I flipped that, and right now my company is like one of three of the biggest companies in D.C., and we stage like 10 homes a week, and I have a staff of 7. In my mind, I purposely called my company the Singing Stager because I had no intention of stopping my music. I knew that if I could get my company to make a shitload of money on a staging end as a biz and teach myself how to be a businesswoman, I could fund my own label. So the Singing Stager, which is what mad realtors in D.C. know as this home staging company, is actually funding It's a Girl Music, which is my record label, which is how I'm able to talk to you right now from this dope-ass studio in my apartment in Hollywood, California, looking at the Netflix building out the window. Like, this was next for me. I'm here in L.A. I'm recording some of the best music that I ever have recorded. I'm out here hitting the ground. I'm recreating myself. I'm starting all over again. And the vibe out here is dope because there are a lot more people who are as talented, as driven, as competitive. And if you are the type of person or artist that will throw yourself in the middle of that, you have no choice. You're either going to go home and fail or just succumb to a life of normalcy, or you'll do like what I'm doing where you look success in the eye. You stand in your living room and you look at the Netflix building and the sign and say, I'm going to be in that building in 8 months. That's what's next for me. Music on other artists, music for myself. I intend to write my way in, which is what I've always done. And what I'm recording now is a mix of Afro beats and R&B. I want to make music that's not going to be so tied to a trend and a genre that it dates itself. I want to make music that keeps, that you'll continue to like it no matter what. You know, I don't want to make everything, I don't want to make totally sad songs. I want to make music that you keep moving to, that lifts us up because of everything that we've gone through as a people, black people, in the last 2 years. I'm not necessarily talking about those events, but I feel like the best artist can embody what the people are feeling and translate that through notes and sounds and beats, and that's what I'm doing. And I love it, and when I love what I do, other people tend to like it too. So it's in process. I'm just living my life recording music and praying that you guys love it too. That's what I'm up to.
I mean, it goes without question. We absolutely loved it. Like I told you, yeah, over the years, the stuff I heard online, I was like, from Giving My Keys to Tripping, I was like, she still has it. I'm like, and the fact is, you never stopped. King, I mean, please, go ahead. I mean, yeah.
Man, what more can I say? That's just a prime example of laying down your destiny and taking upon that path to achieve it. You always got to have a roadmap to success.
And what my brother said is absolutely right, y'all. One thing about it is that it's when you speak of speaking it into existence, the reality is this. Because we got to touch on a few elements to what you said, Lisette, because this is one, because there are so many different elements. Number one is called the second act. We call this in show business when, you know, and then the reemergence, because you found a second career, which is just as lucrative and will always be a stream of income for you. And then, you know, the hustle of, because artists have to understand this, King and myself, we have done hundreds of shows with so many different people that we have been so honored to have on our show. We've never had a bad show ever. In terms of, because we're always grateful for the guests that come on, and the stories they tell us, we try to pass on to younger artists, up and coming. and just artists in general, because the fact is that for some, like yourself, your talent is just so immense that you're always going to have an infinite level of outlets to show it. For some people, if music doesn't work for them, they're shit out of luck. And I'm not saying that to shade anybody. It is to say how real, how cutthroat, how brutal, how engulfing this business can be. You know, King started off as a journalist before he started this show. And he'll tell you some of the stories in terms of when he used to write for Raucous and all these labels, how you see artists come and go. And I have every XXL, once again, a shameless shout out, the Source magazine, XXL. I have every Source magazine since 1994. I have every XXL since 1997. So I've seen all the artists that have come and gone, you know, and, you know, when you look at some artists like Jay-Z, who just went from Hawaiian Soapy with Jazzo to basically just becoming this mogul, same thing for Puffy, you know, an intern at Uptown Records. I mean, of course, you know, assembling the Hitmen, Mario Winans, of course, we know how much Chucky meant to you, because rest in peace, Chucky, because Chucky was such a talented guy. You always credit him with him getting you through that door. You know, to see the transformation, to see the glow up is incredible. And artists have to understand, there is nothing wrong with looking towards the future, because your future is how you secure your stability. It's okay to have a regular job. King and myself, we have regular jobs. We love what we do with this. Will we love a bag for this show? Absolutely. And if someone comes with the right offer, we will take it if it's the right offer. We're not going to sell our, as I've always joked,
exactly,
you know, in a hetero way, we co-parent this child of the show. We co-parent this. So we got to make sure that what is best for the baby, which is this show, we got to make sure that whatever we do is best for everybody involved. His, you know, him, myself, all of our loved ones.
Exactly.
And from that level, let's say, you've shown that, you know, you can't be stopped. I mean, you're the epitome of black rock.
I just, my boyfriend and I had this conversation. I know he's kind of pissed off at me right now because I'm so defensive about it, because there's this thing, and I want to, before I say anything else, I need to say this, like, if anybody is listening out there and you're wondering how you can follow my journey or how you can watch this process, I'm on Instagram. I primarily just do Instagram. I know there's a lot of other social media out there, but I don't have time. I'm making money. You can find me at 08 Lizette, like, oh, Lizette TT. So 08 Lizette, LYSETTETITI. And they've also tagged me on the Off the Cuff Radio site. So if you want to follow my journey and see everything I'm doing, follow me there. I'm very transparent. I run my page. I'm very transparent with everything I'm doing, and I love to inspire people. But, like, what I was about to say was that, like, I can't – he and I just had this conversation because there's a lot of media out there that tells you to focus on one thing at a time in order to be successful. But I come from – you know, I say this all the time. I come from a culture when West African people have a habit of being good, equally good at multiple things. Okay, that's why you could be Akon, make hits, and then change the whole country.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah, we're not the type of, this whole thing of you have to just focus your energy here in order to be, that does apply to some people. But there are some unicorns out there that really does not apply to, where whatever is on your heart, you do have to make time. I will tell you that the only way I'm able to make this work, which is very challenging for me because there are times I'm looking at up and I'm like, damn, I'm not recording as much as I want to, or dang, I'm not doing as much as I want to over here. There are times when I have those moments, but it's all about time management. Like half my week might have to be dedicated to my company and the other half might have to be dedicated to my studio. I have to do it that way. But if you can, if you have the bandwidth to do it like that, you can also be unstoppable. But what stops us a lot of times is not prioritizing and having bad time management. I have no intention of choosing one dream over the other. They may not all happen at the same time, is what people will tell you. But as I'm talking to you right now, I'm interviewing about my music career with you. And today, you know, I made X amount of dollars with my saving company. So I'm just like, we don't have the same music industry that we had before where you're going to walk into any label and off the cuff get $200,000. Rihanna has plenty for a reason. All artists had to diversify. Even the ones that were making a shitload of money had to diversify. If you listening to Beyonce and Jay-Z's lyrics, don't get distracted. They had to diversify in the way they make money. They just didn't tell you. You understand? Like, no, the industry is not what it was before. So now it's about, especially with the pandemic, just breaking it up and managing your time so that you can be successful in maybe two areas at one time. Not four. You know, you might not be able to have a landscape company, a basketball team, an artist career, and it's not without a whole team of people helping you. Done it first. But you can, whatever it is any of you guys want to do, like I'm telling you, I've been to the bottom. I'm in a city, again, in the penthouse, when 15 minutes away, I slept in the park. I don't feel like failure is an option in my life. So it's very simple to make a good song. You just have to keep trying. And I that's where I'm at. I cannot wait for people to hear everything I'm telling you. I'm translating it into a sound. I cannot wait for people to feel that. That's what my next project is going to be, feel like. It's going to feel like everything I just talked about with Pretty Girl on top.
Because we're gonna need an advanced copy of that album. We're dinosaurs. We do CDs. You need to send us that CD.
We drop OGs.
Yeah, we don't want no music file. Damn it, we want the CD. We want that hard copy because that is, yes, because one thing about it, you know, we had DJ Yella on a couple weeks ago from NWA, and he told us about his journey, you know, in terms of, you know, even when he was, you know, doing music, when he left music for a while, when he went into porn directing. And, I mean, at the end of the day, no matter what you do, it's a job. And I think that's where a lot of these artists have to understand that, you know, that, like I said, the music industry may not be there forever. So you have to find something. I mean, Beyonce, she had her fashion line, the House of Darion. You know, Nelly, he had his clothing line with Vocal and Apple Bottoms. I mean, Master P. I mean, this dude did just, I mean, look, I mean, King, what's that thing you said this dude played for? This? Yeah, I mean, this dude lived out 25 hood nigga dreams. I mean, was a basketball player, actor, movie director, you know, rapper. This, I mean,
now he got his own noodles. Now he got his own cereal. Now he got his own Clorox.
Yeah. I mean, the hustle, and, you know, even though
man
he gets
got
a
no
lot
limit
of shit,
noodles.
Yeah, and even though he gets a lot of shit, Puffy, because one thing about Puffy, we all know stories about Puff, things he's done wrong. We're not shading him because this is stuff that's been public. We're not saying anything people have not said before and we have not read. But one thing about it with Puff is also one of those people, a set King, who we know. They said Puffy's, and shout out to our man Doug Young, you know, great friend of ours. Because Doug was in a meeting, and, you know, years ago, Doug told us his story on one of our shows, and Doug said he saw Puffy from a young age just coming in a record label room and just go batshit crazy, just telling him how things was going to be. And he was like, that boy going to be something. And Puffy's known that there's like, if you give him 20 plates, he can spend 20 at one time.
and then 21 just for good measure. You know, Puffy's also one of those people that his vision is crazy in terms of how he wants to put it all together, but he's able to balance everything. You know, you all have a genius with that, Lissette, that is just unbelievable, because not many people can manage that and give it with so much equal aplomb all of your attention in terms of focus, understanding what needs to be done with it.
Right. Thank you.
Yes. I mean, so in terms of the, so in reference to it, pretty much we're assuming this is going to be a solo endeavor in terms of, is there any other artists possibly that you want to work with and that maybe you're looking to bring on for guests on it, or is this pretty much going to be all you?
This one's going to be all me because I need to reintroduce myself, but I mean, I'm in a city full of very amazing, talented people. And my goal is, like, I'm well aware of what needs to happen. I know I need to recreate this. So I'm going to put it out. I'm going to stand on my own first, and I'm going to see what it draws to me. You know, I'm going to see what the vibe is and who this project resonates with, and see how much, you know, how much I can attract the right people to me. You know what I mean?
Mm.
I'm not the go out and try to find people to build me up type of artist. That's not how I am. You know, I never been that artist. But yeah, I mean, I appreciate you guys having me. And like, it's just about the future. It's about the future for me. It's about the future for everybody listening, for all both of you guys. You know, it's like we got a lot of pressure on us now. Like everybody has to. Right now, life is about living. What are you going to do with it? Like me, I don't know about y'all, but I've in the space of 30 days, I've buried two of my closest friends, and the deaths have not been like nobody was sick, you know, 48 hours before their surprise death. I want to live my life now. You know what I'm saying? Like who are we right now after we survive being in the house, after we survive? If you didn't get COVID and die, yo, you got a lot to prove. Who are you right now? And
Cassidy, yeah, Cassidy told us this when he came on.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Cassidy told us this when he came on our show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You got to take advantage of the time you have over here because you never know when is that time. Life is very fragile.
Yeah.
You got to.
You know, I got to give a heavenly shout-out to one of my good friends we buried this week, Keith Robinson, you know, Robinson, my neighbor. It was, you know, he had been sick for a while, and, you know, he had passed. And, you know, like you said, like my man Red in Saul St. Redemption said, you know, get busy living or get busy dying. You know, and that's something where it's true. We had Cassidy on last year, and Cassidy said about it, you know, when he was talking about his time in the industry, you know, and just how he's – and Cassidy still has it. And he was telling all the artists, if you have not honed your craft, if you have not gotten better by the time we come outside again, he's like, what have you been doing all of this time? You know, when the pandemic hit, King and myself, we were still busy working, still are working, still getting people booked for the show. You know, we ain't stopped. You know, it's like – We got to do this. This is what we love, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what it's about. So, yeah, I hope everybody heard. I hope they felt what I'm saying because all this stuff is coming from my heart, y'all. And I am very excited and grateful to be where I am physically and where I am mentally. I'm fine. I'm not that one-hit artist that you're never going to hear from again. I'm the artist that you haven't heard from yet. Like, I'm not the stoppable person. I'm going to continue to make music, and everything I make is going to be, like, 100% my heart into it. I'm a perfectionist in my craft, and I do want to create a whole new sound. I want to create a whole new vibe. I look forward to being that artist that, you know, people recognize is that's different. Same thing that happened with Young Static Blue. Everything I make is, like, it's always different. It's always for, I'd rather set a trend than follow it. If you want to follow me on my journey, you can do so. I'm at on Instagram at olysettt. That's OlysetteTTi. My friends call me TT. I'm on Lizette, O-L-A-O Lizette. I got to run, y'all. I've appreciated this time, but I got to run. I got to go get a, there's a Thunderbolt court that I need for my studio because I just got a new computer and I want to record tonight. I'm actually trying to get in with, I'm doing everything I can to get into this session with this artist that we all know and love. She's here. She's recording. People have compared me to her, and I have an invitation to come into the session and possibly write for her, so I'm trying to get out of here and do that. But I appreciate
Absolutely.
Y'all having me on the soda. Yes.
Lizette, thank you so much.
Anytime.
You are welcome back anytime. Yes, you are welcome back. You're welcome back on this show. We love you. Thank you so much. Send us that new music when everything is ready. You're an inspiration. It is so incredible. Thank you. That's all we can say. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. All right, y'all. Bye, Eric. Bye-bye.
Much love.
Later. Much love. Peace.
So, yeah, on that note, we about to sign up out of here.
Yeah.
A lot of dope information that was dropped tonight. Big shout-out to Lizette. Dope show. Another one in the books.
Yeah, and you know, next week, you know, we're going to be back at it. Same bat channel, same bat time with the OTC, you know, doing it so lovely, man. So thank y'all again. God bless y'all. Good night, and you'll see us back at it.
Already.
Peace. We out.